Damn him, I certainly did want to see Dmitri, but now there's no need, said Ivan reluctantly. What of Dmitri and father? How will it end? Asked Alishaw anxiously. You are always harping upon it. What have I to do with it? Am I my brother Dmitri's keeper? Ivan snapped irritably, but then he suddenly smiled bitterly. Cain's answer about his murdered brother, wasn't it? Perhaps that's what you're thinking at this moment? Well, damn it all, I can't stay here to be their keeper, can I? I finished what I had to do, and I am going. Do you imagine I am jealous of Dmitri? That I've been trying to steal his beautiful Katerina Ivanovna for the last 3 months? Nonsense, I had business of my own. I finished it. I am going. I finished it just now, you were a witness. At Katerina Ivanovna's? Yes, and I've released myself once for all. And after all, what have I to do with Dmitri? Dmitri doesn't come in. I had my own business to settle with Katerina Ivanovna. You know, on the contrary, that Dmitri behaved as though there was an understanding between us. I didn't ask to do it, but he solemnly handed her over to me and gave us his blessing. It's all too funny. Ah, Alishaw, if you only knew how light my heart is now. Would you believe it, I sat here eating my dinner and was nearly ordering champagne to celebrate my first hour of freedom. Phew. It's been going on nearly 6 months, and all at once I've thrown it off. I could never have guessed even yesterday, how easy it would be to put an end to it if I wanted. You are speaking of your love, Ivan? Of my love, if you like. I fell in love with the young lady, I worried myself over her and she worried me. I sat watching over her. And all at once it's collapsed. I spoke this morning with inspiration, but I went away and roared with laughter. Would you believe it? Yes, it's the literal truth. You seem very merry about it now, observed Alishaw, looking into his face, which had suddenly grown brighter. But how could I tell that I didn't care for her a bit? Ha ha. It appears after all I didn't. And yet how she attracted me. How attractive she was just now when I made my speech. And do you know she attracts me awfully even now, yet how easy it is to leave her. Do you think I am boasting? No, only perhaps it wasn't love. Alishaw, laughed Ivan, don't make reflections about love, it's unseemly for you. How you rushed into the discussion this morning. I've forgotten to kiss you for it. But how she tormented me. It certainly was sitting by a laceration. Ah, she knew how I loved her. She loved me and not Dmitri, Ivan insisted gaily. Her feeling for Dmitri was simply a self-laceration. All I told her just now was perfectly true, but the worst of it is, it may take her 15 or 20 years to find out that she doesn't care for Dmitri, and loves me whom she torments, and perhaps she may never find it out at all, in spite of her lesson today. Well, it's better so, I can simply go away for good. By the way, how is she now? What happened after I departed? Alishaw told him she had been hysterical, and that she was now, he heard, unconscious and delirious. Isn't Madame Holikoff laying it on? I think not. I must find out. Nobody dies of hysterics, though. They don't matter. God gave woman hysterics as a relief. I won't go to her at all. Why push myself forward again? But you told her that she had never cared for you. I did that on purpose. Alishaw, shall I call for some champagne? Let us drink to my freedom. Ah, if only you knew how glad I am. No, brother, we had better not drink, said Alishaw suddenly. Besides, I feel somehow depressed. Yes, you've been depressed a long time, I've noticed it. Have you settled to go tomorrow morning, then? Morning? I didn't say I should go in the morning. But perhaps it may be the morning. Would you believe it, I dined here today only to avoid dining with the old man, I loathe him so. I should have left long ago, so far as he is concerned. But why are you so worried about my going away? We've plenty of time before I go, an eternity. If you are going away too, Morrow, what do you mean by an eternity? But what does it matter to us? Laughed Ivan. We've time enough for our talk, for what brought us here. Why do you look so surprised? Answer, why have we met here? To talk of my love for Katerina Ivanovna, of the old man and Dmitri? Of foreign travel? Of the fatal position of Russia? Of the Emperor Napoleon? Is that it? No. Then you know what for. It's different for other people. But we in our green youth have to settle the eternal questions first of all. That's what we care about. Young Russia is talking about nothing but the eternal questions now. Just when the old folks are all taken up with practical questions. Why have you been looking at me in expectation for the last 3 months? To ask me, what do you believe, or don't you believe at all? That's what your eyes have been meaning for these 3 months, haven't they? Perhaps so, smiled Alishaw. You are not laughing at me, now, Ivan? Me laughing. I don't want to wound my little brother who has been watching me with such expectation for 3 months. Alishaw, look straight at me. Of course, I am just such a little boy as you are, only not a novice. And what have Russian boys been doing up till now, some of them, I mean? In this stinking tavern, for instance, here, they meet and sit down in a corner. They've never met in their lives before and, when they go out of the tavern, they won't meet again for 40 years. And what do they talk about in that momentary halt in the tavern? Of the eternal questions, of the existence of God and immortality. And those who do not believe in God talk of socialism or anarchism, of the transformation of all humanity on a new pattern, so that it all comes to the same, they're the same questions turned inside out. And masses? Masses of the most original Russian boys do nothing but talk of the eternal questions. Isn't it so? Yes, for real Russians the questions of God's existence and of immortality, or, as you say, the same questions turned inside out, come first and foremost, of course, and so they should, said Alishaw, still watching his brother with the same gentle and inquiring smile. Well, Alishaw, it's sometimes very unwise to be a Russian at all. But anything stupider than the way Russian boys spend their time one can hardly imagine. But there's one Russian boy called Alishaw I am awfully fond of. How nicely you put that in. Alishaw laughed suddenly. Well, tell me where to begin, give your orders. The existence of God, eh? Begin where you like. You declared yesterday at Father's that there was no God. Alishaw looked searchingly at his brother. I said that yesterday at dinner on purpose to tease you and I saw your eyes glow. But now I've no objection to discussing with you, and I say so very seriously. I want to be friends with you, Alishaw, for I have no friends and want to try it. Well, only fancy, perhaps I too accept God, laughed Ivan, that's a surprise for you, isn't it? Yes, of course, if you are not joking now. Joking? I was told at the elders yesterday that I was joking. You know, dear boy, there was an old sinner in the 18th century who declared that, if there were no God, he would have to be invented. S'il n'existait pas Dieu, il faudrait l'inventer. And man has actually invented God. And what's strange, what would be marvelous, is not that God should really exist. The marvel is that such an idea, the idea of the necessity of God, could enter the head of such a savage, vicious beast as man. So holy it is, so touching, so wise and so great a credit it does to man. As for me, I've long resolved not to think whether man created God or God-man. And I won't go through all the axioms laid down by Russian boys on that subject, all derived from European hypotheses. For what's a hypothesis? There is an axiom with the Russian boy, and not only with the boys but with their teachers too, for our Russian professors are often just the same boys themselves. And so I omit all the hypotheses. For what are we aiming at now? I am trying to explain as quickly as possible my essential nature, that is what manner of man I am, what I believe in, and for what I hope, that's it, isn't it? And therefore I tell you that I accept God simply. But you must note this, If God exists and if he really did create the world, then, as we all know, he created it according to the geometry of Euclid and the human mind with the conception of only three dimensions in space. Yet there have been and still are geometricians and philosophers, and even some of the most distinguished, who doubt whether the whole universe, or to speak more widely, the whole of being, was only created in Euclid's geometry. They even dare to dream that two parallel lines, which according to Euclid can never meet on Earth, may meet somewhere in infinity. I have come to the conclusion that, since I can't understand even that, I can't expect to understand about God. I acknowledge humbly that I have no faculty for settling such questions. I have a Euclidean earthly mind, and how could I solve problems that are not of this world? And I advise you never to think about it either, my dear Alishaw, especially about God, whether he exists or not. All such questions are utterly inappropriate for a mind created with an idea of only three dimensions. And so I accept God and am glad to, and what's more, I accept his wisdom, his purpose which are utterly beyond our ken. I believe in the underlying order and the meaning of life. I believe in the eternal harmony in which they say we shall one day be blended. I believe in the word to which the universe is striving, and which itself was with God, and which itself is God and so on, to infinity. There are all sorts of phrases for it. I seem to be on the right path, don't I? Yet would you believe it, in the final result I don't accept this world of God's, and, although I know it exists, I don't accept it at all. It's not that I don't accept God, you must understand, it's the world created by him I don't and cannot accept. Let me make it plain. I believe like a child that suffering will be healed and made up for, that all the humiliating absurdity of human contradictions will vanish like a pitiful mirage, like the despicable fabrication of the impotent and infinitely small Euclidean mind of man, that in the world's finale, at the moment of eternal harmony, something so precious will come to pass that it will suffice for all hearts, for the comforting of all resentments, for the atonement of all the crimes of humanity, of all the blood they've shed, that it will make it not only possible to forgive but to justify all that has happened with men, but thought all that may come to pass. I don't accept it. I won't accept it. Even if parallel lines do meet and I see it myself, I shall see it and say that they've met, but still I won't accept it. That's what's at the root of me, Alishaw, that's my creed. I am in earnest in what I say. I began our talk as stupidly as I could on purpose, but I've led up to my confession, for that's all you want. You didn't want to hear about God, but only to know what the brother you love lives by. And so I've told you. Ivan concluded his long tirade with marked and unexpected feeling. And why did you begin as stupidly as you could? Asked Alishaw, looking dreamily at him. To begin with, for the sake of being Russian. Russian conversations on such subjects are always carried on inconceivably stupidly. And secondly, the stupider one is, the closer one is to reality. The stupider one is, the clearer one is. Stupidity is brief and artless, while intelligence wriggles and hides itself. Intelligence is a knave, but stupidity is honest and straightforward. I've led the conversation to my despair, and the more stupidly I have presented it, the better for me. You will explain why you don't accept the world? Said Alishaw. To be sure I will, it's not a secret, that's what I've been leading up to. Dear little brother, I don't want to corrupt you or to turn you from your stronghold, perhaps I want to be healed by you. Ivan smiled suddenly quite like a little gentle child. Alishaw had never seen such a smile on his face before. Chapter 4, Rebellion. I must make one confession, Ivan began. I could never understand how one can love one's neighbors. It's just one's neighbors, to my mind, that one can't love, though one might love those at a distance. I once read somewhere of John the Merciful, a saint, that when a hungry, frozen beggar came to him, he took him into his bed, held him in his arms, and began breathing into his mouth, which was putrid and loathsome from some awful disease. I am convinced that he did that from self-laceration, from the self, laceration of falsity, for the sake of the charity imposed by duty, as a penance laid on him. For anyone to love man, he must be hidden, for as soon as he shows his face, love is gone. Father Zossima has talked of that more than once, observed Alishaw. He, too, said that the face of a man often hinders many people not practiced in love, from loving him. But yet there's a great deal of love in mankind, and almost Christ, like love. I know that myself, Ivan. Well, I know nothing of it so far, and can't understand it, and the innumerable mass of mankind are with me there. The question is, whether that's due to men's bad qualities or whether it's inherent in their nature. To my thinking, Christ, like love for men, is a miracle impossible on earth. He was God. But we are not gods. Suppose I, for instance, suffer intensely. Another can never know how much I suffer, because he is another and not I. And what's more, a man is rarely ready to admit another's suffering, as though it were a distinction. Why won't he admit it, do you think? Because I smell unpleasant, because I have a stupid face, because I once trod on his foot. Besides, there is suffering and suffering, degrading, humiliating suffering such as humbles me, hunger, for instance. My benefactor will perhaps allow me, but when you come to higher suffering, for an idea, for instance, he will very rarely admit that, perhaps because my face strikes him as not at all what he fancies a man should have who suffers for an idea. And so he deprives me instantly of his favor, and not at all from badness of heart. Beggars, especially genteel beggars, ought never to show themselves, but to ask for charity through the newspapers. One can love one's neighbors in the abstract, or even at a distance, but at close quarters it's almost impossible. If it were as on the stage, in the ballet, where if beggars come in, they wear silken rags and tattered lace and beg for alms dancing gracefully, then one might like looking at them. But even then we should not love them. But enough of that. I simply wanted to show you my point of view. I meant to speak of the suffering of mankind generally. But we had better confine ourselves to the sufferings of the children. That reduces the scope of my argument to a tenth of what it would be. Still, we'd better keep to the children, though it does weaken my case. But, in the first place, children can be loved even at close quarters, even when they are dirty, even when they are ugly. I fancy, though, children never are ugly. The second reason why I won't speak of grown up people is that, besides being disgusting and unworthy of love, they have a compensation. They've eaten the apple and know good and evil, and they have become like gods. They go on eating it still. But the children haven't eaten anything, and are so far innocent. Are you fond of children, Alishaw? I know you are, and you will understand why I prefer to speak of them. If they, too, suffer horribly on earth, they must suffer for their father's sins. They must be punished for their fathers, who have eaten the apple. But that reasoning is of the other world and is incomprehensible for the heart of man here on earth. The innocent must not suffer for another's sins, and especially such innocents. You may be surprised at me, Alishaw, but I am awfully fond of children, too. And observe, cruel people. The violent, the rapacious. The Karamazovs are sometimes very fond of children. Children, while they are quite little, up to 7, for instance, are so remote from grown-up people they are different creatures, as it were, of a different species. I knew a criminal in prison who had, in the course of his career as a burglar, murdered whole families, including several children. But when he was in prison, he had a strange affection for them. He spent all his time at his window, watching the children playing in the prison yard. He trained one little boy to come up to his window and made great friends with him. You don't know why I am telling you all this, Alishaw? My head aches and I am sad. You speak with a strange air, observed Alishaw uneasily, as though you were not quite yourself. By the way, a Bulgarian I met lately in Moscow, Ivan went on, seeming not to hear his brother's words, told me about the crimes committed by Turks and Circassians in all parts of Bulgaria through fear of a general rising of the Slavs. They burn villages, murder, outrage women and children, they nail their prisoners by the ears to the fences, leave them so till morning, and in the morning they hang them, all sorts of things you can't imagine. People talk sometimes of bestial cruelty, but that's a great injustice and insult to the beasts. A beast can never be so cruel as a man, so artistically cruel. The tiger only tears and gnaws, that's all he can do. He would never think of nailing people by the ears, even if he were able to do it. These Turks took a pleasure in torturing children, too, cutting the unborn child from the mother's womb, and tossing babies up in the air and catching them on the points of their bayonets before their mother's eyes. Doing it before the mother's eyes was what gave zest to the amusement. Here is another scene that I thought very interesting. Imagine a trembling mother with her baby in her arms, a circle of invading Turks around her. They've planned a diversion, they pet the baby, laugh to make it laugh. They succeed, the baby laughs. At that moment a Turk points a pistol 4 inches from the baby's face. The baby laughs with glee, holds out its little hands to the pistol, and he pulls the trigger in the baby's face and blows out its brains. Artistic, wasn't it? By the way, Turks are particularly fond of sweet things, they say. Brother, what are you driving at? Asked Alishaw. I think if the devil doesn't exist, but man has created him, he has created him in his own image and likeness. Just as he did God, then? Observed Alishaw. It's wonderful how you can turn words, as Polonius says in Hamlet, laughed Ivan. You turn my words against me. Well, I am glad. Yours must be a fine God, if man created him in his image and likeness. You asked just now what I was driving at. You see, I am fond of collecting certain facts, and, would you believe, I even copy anecdotes of a certain sort from newspapers and books, and I've already got a fine collection. The Turks, of course, have gone into it, but they are foreigners. I have specimens from home that are even better than the Turks. You know we prefer beating, rods and scourges, that's our national institution. Nailing ears is unthinkable for us, for we are, after all, Europeans. But the rod and the scourge we have always with us and they cannot be taken from us. Abroad now they scarcely do any beating. Manners are more humane, all laws have been passed, so that they don't dare to flog men now. But they make up for it in another way just as national as ours. And so national that it would be practically impossible among us, though I believe we are being inoculated with it, since the religious movement began in our aristocracy. I have a charming pamphlet, translated from the French, describing how, quite recently, 5 years ago, a murderer, Richard, was executed, a young man, I believe, of 23, who repented and was converted to the Christian faith at the very scaffold. This Richard was an illegitimate child who was given as a child of 6 by his parents to some shepherds on the Swiss mountains. They brought him up to work for them. He grew up like a little wild beast among them. The shepherds taught him nothing, and scarcely fed or clothed him, but sent him out at 7 to herd the flock in cold and wet, and no one hesitated or scrupled to treat him so. Quite the contrary, they thought they had every right, for Richard had been given to them as a chattel, and they did not even see the necessity of feeding him. Richard himself describes how in those years, like the prodigal son in the Gospel, he longed to eat of the mash given to the pigs, which were fattened for sale. But they wouldn't even give that, and beat him when he stole from the pigs. And that was how he spent all his childhood and his youth, till he grew up and was strong enough to go away and be a thief. The savage began to earn his living as a day laborer in Geneva. He drank what he earned, he lived like a brute, and finished by killing and robbing an old man. He was caught, tried, and condemned to death. They are not sentimentalists there. And in prison he was immediately surrounded by pastors, members of Christian brotherhoods, philanthropic ladies, and the like. They taught him to read and write in prison, and expounded the gospel to him. They exhorted him, worked upon him, drummed at him incessantly, till at last he solemnly confessed his crime. He was converted. He wrote to the court himself that he was a monster, but that in the end God had vouchsafed him light and shown grace. All Geneva was in excitement about him, all philanthropic and religious Geneva. All the aristocratic and well-bred society of the town rushed to the prison, kissed Richard and embraced him. "You are our brother, you have found grace." And Richard does nothing but weep with emotion. "Yes, I found grace. All my youth and childhood I was glad of pig's food, but now even I have found grace. I am dying in the Lord." "Yes, Richard, die in the Lord, you have shed blood and must die. Though it's not your fault that you knew not the Lord, when you coveted the pig's food and were beaten for stealing it, which was very wrong of you, for stealing is forbidden, but you've shed blood and you must die." And on the last day, Richard, perfectly limp, did nothing but cry and repeat every minute, "This is my happiest day. I am going to the Lord." "Yes," cry the pastors and the judges and philanthropic ladies. "This is the happiest day of your life, for you are going to the Lord." They all walk or drive to the scaffold in procession behind the prison van. At the scaffold they call to Richard, "Die, brother, die in the Lord, for even thou hast found grace." And so, covered with his brother's kisses, Richard is dragged onto the scaffold, and led to the guillotine. And they chopped off his head in brotherly fashion, because he had found grace. Yes, that's characteristic. That pamphlet is translated into Russian by some Russian philanthropists of aristocratic rank and evangelical aspirations, and has been distributed gratis for the enlightenment of the people. The case of Richard is interesting because it's national. Though to us it's absurd to cut off a man's head, because he has become our brother and has found grace, yet we have our own speciality, which is all but worse. Our historical pastime is the direct satisfaction of inflicting pain. There are lines in Nekrasov describing how a peasant lashes a horse on the eyes, on its meek eyes. Everyone must have seen it. It's peculiarly Russian. He describes how a feeble little nag has foundered under too heavy a load and cannot move. The peasant beats it savagely, beats it at last not knowing what he is doing in the intoxication of cruelty, thrashes it mercilessly over and over again. "However weak you are, you must pull, if you die for it." The nag strains, and then he begins lashing the poor defenseless creature on its weeping, on its meek eyes. The frantic beast tugs and draws the load, trembling all over, gasping for breath, moving sideways, with a sort of unnatural spasmodic action. It's awful in Nekrasov. But that only a horse, and God has horses to be beaten. So the tatters have taught us, and they left us them as a remembrance of it. But men, too, can be beaten. A well-educated, cultured gentleman and his wife beat their own child with a birch rod, a girl of 7. I have an exact account of it. The papa was glad that the birch was covered with twigs. "It stings more," said he, and so B began stinging his daughter. I know for a fact there are people who at every blow are worked up to sensuality, to literal sensuality, which increases progressively at every blow they inflict. They beat for a minute, for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, more often and more savagely. The child screams. At last the child cannot scream, it gasps, "Daddy, daddy." By some diabolical unseemly chance the case was brought into court. A counsel is engaged. The Russian people have long called a barrister a conscience for hire. The counsel protests in his client's defense. "It's such a simple thing," he says, "an everyday domestic event. A father corrects his child. To our shame be it said. It is brought into court. The jury, convinced by him, give a favorable verdict. The public roars with delight that the torturer is acquitted. Ah, pity I wasn't there. I would have proposed to raise a subscription in his honor. Charming pictures. But I've still better things about children. I've collected a great, great deal about Russian children. Alishaw, There was a little girl of 5 who was hated by her father and mother, most worthy and respectable people, of good education and breeding. You see, I must repeat again, it is a peculiar characteristic of many people, this love of torturing children, and children only.